The Diversity Hires at Div Hires Pod across all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Hit that Patreon page. Give us a little bit of money if you want to keep this thing afloat. That's patreon.com/DivHiresPod. TheDiversityHires.com. Send us a note. Join the mailing list. You know the deal. Shu, another exciting guest today.
Yes, today we have Melinda Shu Taylor on, my former co-worker on the Vampire Diaries, a showrunner of Nancy Drew now. And we're so excited to have her on. You know, we're continuing this I guess we could call it a series. I don't really want to call it that, but we're
ongoing discussion.
There you go. We're continuing this ongoing discussion, talking with some of our Asian American colleagues and friends, other writers. So we're doing that again today. So happy to have her on, ready to get into it.
Do I understand correctly that we're all Julie Plec alums and we're all Columbia alums?
This is what makes this a fantastic episode. I'm really excited about this. The points of connection are actually like great and also mystifying in another way. So it should be really interesting. It's really unique.
Love it. Hit the music. Welcome to The Diversity Hires, where Sherman Shu shoot the shit about screenwriting.
We are two professional film and television writers living and working in Los Angeles, and we come here every week to give you the lowdown on the business, the culture, and please let us not forget the craft of writing for film and television. From a distinctly Black point of view, I am your co-host, Shukri Hassan Tillman. Most people call me Shu.
Today's agenda, got the suitcase up in the Sentra. You know who it is. It's the G-Swoke, the greatest screenwriter of all time, the living embodiment of Courier Font, your favorite screenwriter's favorite screenwriter, your other co-host, Sherman Payne. Excited to be here today.
But that's pretty good, especially considering you're a little fatigued today.
Yeah, man. As we were talking about offline, I got the second jab of the Pfizer vaccine yesterday. You know, it's not so bad. You know, I definitely got a headache right away. Then I felt very like fatigued, I think is the right word. You know, have you ever, I'm sure you have, you've gone to an amusement park and not realized that you've walked around literally all day. And then the first time you sit down, you don't feel necessarily sore or in pain. You just feel like you walked around all day. I sort of felt like that immediately. And then today when I woke up, very sore arm where they shot me, and I feel a little bit slow. I feel a little just exhausted and mentally slow. So fair warning to the listeners, if I don't seem my usual G-Swoke sharp self today, please blame it on the Pfizer vaccine, but I'm glad to endure one day of that so that I can have ongoing protection from the pandemic.
I've heard from several women in my life, including my wife, who have been vaccinated or had their husbands or significant others or male friends be vaccinated, that your response to the vaccination is a direct corollary to your response to the man cold.
The man, what is the man cold? This is like a new term to me. I feel like this is going to be
essentially
either great or very misogynist. So let's see.
No. Okay. Essentially, if you are a man who tends to, you know, complain so much when you get sick, when you have like a cold, that you're just like, oh my God, I'm burning up. I'm sneezing. Right. I'm sniffling. Please, honey, give me the tissue.
Right.
Then you are going to be that person, that same person after you get your vaccination. And so, as a friend of mine told me,
Well, let me
say, I was having chills and stuff, and you know, my wife had no sympathy. So,
oh really? Okay,
yeah, of course.
Well, that's the opposite in my household. Honestly, my wife really? Has a much higher response to pain and discomfort in a medical or sickness situation than I do. But like, I actually have a super high tolerance for colds, man. I like walk right through them; they don't bother me. Back in the day when it used to be like appropriate, you could still go to work with like a tiny little cold and people wouldn't look at you crazy. I'd be like walking right through it, man. No problem.
Okay. I mean, you're a better man than I. I often fall victim to the so-called man cold.
So you're like whining about it?
Oh, I can't stand it.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
I mean, I think I feel very sick, but I can see that from the outside. It looks like, come on, like this is just allergies. You know what I mean? Like, say you're cold. So what? Like, you know.
Yes, that's my attitude. So what? Yeah. So let's not get into a medical podcast. But what I'll say is, like, that's sort of what I feel about the symptoms that I'm having from this vaccine. It's a little uncomfortable, but honestly, so what?
I got you. So look, the good thing is segueing to Hollywood, why we're here for this podcast, why we talk about it. You know, the good thing about the vaccinations, they're picking up. I really think we could be heading to another surge, but
you said it
a couple of weeks ago that was going to happen. Smart enough to.
Every day, the New York Times publishes the graph, and it was going down, down, down as a 2-week average, and now it's going up, up, up. We are in a race to get people vaccinated before it becomes a full-blown, whatever, fourth or fifth surge. Can you even call it a surge if it's happened 4 or 5 times? Or are you just, not responsible and you're going to always be at a high rate?
Unfortunately, it's kind of just what we do. And I think for our industry, it's really troublesome. As you know, we're all sort of coming back to, we've been in production and are sort of in this, heavy COVID protocols type of production, which is difficult for a lot of different reasons,
yes,
which we've talked about on this podcast before. And I think, the more people that get vaccinated, the more we can start to see light at the end of the tunnel in terms of production, in terms of, being able to get to a place where we're lifting those COVID protocols, or maybe there could be a scene with, 12 extras,
right,
or something like that. Maybe we can have like a basketball game on screen, but or have more than 2 people in a room. But so I'm hoping that we get to that place at a certain point, but we'll see. Hopefully we're not that's going to be determined soon.
Well, let me ask you one question and then we should move on.
Yeah.
One question is, if everybody's vaccinated, are you excited to go back to the writer's room, physically be in a room with people, or are you enjoying the virtual meeting, being in your house, just rolling out of bed, going to your desk and being on Zoom? Would you like to be back in the writer's room?
That's a fantastic question. I'm going to say this. I am not one of these people that hate Zoom. I hate some of the things about it, but they are far outweighed for me by the fact that I can roll out of bed and turn on my computer and be in the writer's room.
Oh man.
The time drags on Zoom 100%. Everybody knows that, 1 hour in the real world is, or 1 hour on Zoom is 2 hours in the real world. That's for real.
Yeah.
But I think I miss the sort of like personal energy of being in a room with other people, but I mean, it's gonna be hard. Let's put it that way.
I would love to be. I mean, I'm not staffed on a show at this exact moment. Shameless just ended, as people know, or it's ending in a couple weeks, as people know. But I'm not. I would love to never be on a Zoom call again. I hate it. You said like 1 hour on Zoom is like 2 hours, and no, 1 hour on Zoom is like 1,000 hours in real life for me. It's horrible. It's excruciating. So,
Look, let's move on real quick to anything Hollywood related, and then I'm going to talk about one more thing, and then we'll bring in our guest. So,
sounds good.
What's up with you in terms of just what have you been watching? What's happening in Hollywood that sort of, if anything, that sort of got you going today?
You know, I mean, let's go down this lane. You know what I've been watching? I've been watching this show, Generation on HBO Max, which is like a edgy teen dramedy show. And I'm like wondering how HBO Max put out Generation and HBO proper put out Euphoria, and they really check all of the same boxes. That's so crazy to me, because you know what I'm thinking about, Shu? All the times I've gone into a network to pitch something or a streamer, and they've said, we're developing something exactly like that. We love your work, but we're developing something very similar. I'm like, you liars. That doesn't stop you. That doesn't stop you at all. You put out the same show.
Well, when they're all vertically integrated, it's going to be impossible not to, isn't it? I mean, they're all going to. So, I mean, they're, it's impossible. You're going to have multiple things that are around the same area, I would guess. Because
I guess, you know, CBS puts out the same style procedurals all the time. But, you know, I always thought that what was beautiful about streamers and cable is that things can be radically different and specific. And so when they gave me that excuse, and I've heard that excuse a couple times, I always thought, yeah, that's probably true. You don't want two shows that check the same boxes. You're trying to be, you know, on brand, but also very specific to each show. But that's out the window now, man. Anytime somebody says that to me, I'm going to just say Euphoria and Generation. And I like both shows, by the way. That's not a slight to either show. I really enjoy both shows. But I'm going to let them know. You guys can put out the same thing twice.
I got you.
What about you?
Look, I'm just going to bring up two very quick things. I mean, I'm going to reiterate my love for Young Rock.
You're still on the Young Rock wave. I thought maybe that was flying by now.
It's flying under the radar, people, and you have to watch. It's a great, great show. It's so sweet. It's fantastic.
Are you angling for a job on Young Rock?
Like, No, I don't write comedies, bro.
This is just about genuinely loving the show. Huh?
I genuinely am shocked by the fact that I love it. Shocked. But I love the show. It's fantastic. I just love it. Love the showrunner. It's great. And I will just say that, you know, I'm back. I'm still in the catalog. I don't know if I think I mentioned it on the podcast before. So those who don't know, I'm back in the catalog of Martin and of Frasier. I'll say that Frasier season 3 starts to fall off. And Martin stays consistent. Maybe not better, but it remains consistent. So I'll update everybody
consistent,
with that.
But Martin is also unchanging.
Yeah.
It never aspired to evolve, which is part of its beauty, is that you can watch any episode of Martin in any season, and you have the exact same circumstances as you did episode 1 of season 1. And you can just fall into it comfortably.
That's true.
Yeah.
And look, and we should bring our guests in here, but I want to hard left as we do in these episodes, you know, to some things that are going on in the world, because I would be remiss not to mention two things. Number one, you know, the Derek Chauvin trial started this week. When we're recording this, it started 2 days ago.
I'm having
a tremendously difficult time grappling with the fact that I think this is going to, not because of the merits of the case, but I think it's going to end up, if history is any predictor, in a disappointing result. And so I'm sort of wrestling with the emotions that go along with that.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Yes, it's extremely sad. And then secondly, and this is a part of, you know, why we want to talk to our, you know, our Asian American friends and colleagues on this podcast, is that this anti-Asian American violence continues to happen as we record this 2 days ago in New York City in a clip that went viral, which I cannot stomach watching these things anymore. This goes for sort of any of these recorded violent events.
Yeah.
But, you know, a 65-year-old woman was attacked right out on 43rd Street near Times Square at 11 something in the morning, broad daylight. And the inaction, if you've seen this clip or read about it, the inaction of the bystanders around is appalling. Mm. And I say this only to say, as hard of a segue as this is, I say this only to say that, because I know we've talked about this offline, but people may not know, that like, I feel, and I know I speak for you, Sherman, that it's important for us Black people mm-hmm. who are in, you know, Black spaces like this podcast to talk about, be open about, and be open in our condemnation of these violent attacks, because at least in a couple of cases, mm-hmm. they are committed by people who are Black. And it's very important that we say some shit about that and condemn it outright and not be silent about it. And so, you know, I don't want to be preachy here, but that's a reason that we come to this space and say the outspoken shit that we try to say.
And it's why we, and maybe this is a better segue than a hard left we just took. It's why we want to uplift other minority voices, even as we are a 90% Black ass podcast. We want to, especially in times like these, use this very modest platform to uplift and amplify other voices and hear directly from people who are, you know, affected by this culturally more than us. So I want to absolutely invite our guests to join the conversation.
Yes. Let's give her a proper introduction. Melinda Shue mm-hmm. Taylor, we share a name. How are you doing?
I'm great. All things considered, you know, with the pandemic and everything in the world. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Of course.
Thrilled to have you.
We're so glad you're on. I mentioned at the top of the podcast that I met you because we worked together on The Vampire Diaries, mm-hmm. the final season of The Vampire Diaries, which was a great experience. Mm-hmm. But first, we want to walk through your career and talk to you about all that. First, I just want to open the floor, like, you know, if you have any thoughts, anything that you want to express about what's going on, either in the New York clip or anything in general, feel free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could not bring myself to watch the New York clip either. It's really disheartening. I realized the other night that I was in a terrible mood at the end of the night. And I was like, oh, it's because I've been on Twitter for half an hour, just scrolling. And I'm trying to wean myself off of that a little bit. I just got kind of down about how people can be. And I have to focus on how people can also be, which is awesome at times. And that they can be called out to be better versions of themselves. And I have to believe that, you know. Mm-hmm. I think... this is a really interesting moment to be on this podcast for me also. I mean, we'll get into these things. But among other things, I've been developing a pilot called Tom Swift as a spinoff, hopefully, knock wood, of the Nancy Druniverse, as we call it, collaborating with a writer named Cameron Johnson, who is fantastic because we made Tom Swift a Black gay man. And, you know, while Noga Landau and I, who were, you know, also EPs on that pilot, we are many things, but we are not Black gay men. And so we really wanted somebody to bring that voice. And Cameron did it with such style and, you know, wonderful depth and talent. So I'm really excited about that project. On Nancy Drew, we've been exploring a number of themes about the Black experience, partly because after the Black Lives Matter, you know, phenomenon happened last summer, at least, you know, kind of came onto our radar in a more real way. Not that it was a new phenomenon, but for us as writers, we intentionally did some storylines that had more focus on the experience of this one character on the show, whose name is Nick, and specifically about what it's like to be a Black guy in an all-white town, or mostly white town. Mm-hmm. The CW is really diverse in its casting, and I think we do a pretty good job behind the scenes. And they're very also intentional about wanting to have lots of different folks on screen. But the reality in Maine, where I grew up and where this show is set, it's mostly white. And so we had some honest looks at what that is like for Nick as a character, even in the reality of the Druniverse, which is kind of a slightly heightened reality where there are ghosts and extremely, you know, multiracial casts, which is great. But if you dropped our cast into the middle of actual coastal Maine, they would get a lot of looks. You know, like, right. Wow, what are these people? They're clearly not from around here. And I find Mainers generally wonderful and it's nothing against them. It's just kind of what the demographic has been historically in that part of the world. Mm. So there are those two things going on. And then specifically, this is a great time to talk about an episode that we have coming up. But I will get to all that after I give you my little spiel. I know that you suggested I give the audience just a snapshot of how I came to be sitting here with these giant headphones on.
Yeah, I'd love to know, like, how you go from Maine to Columbia, where we have some commonality and how you break in. Yeah, tell us a bit.
Before Real quick, Columbia's got to start paying us, or at least excuse, or at least excuse some of these loans, because we're doing great advertisement for the Columbia MFA program. I'm teaching there currently.
Oh, cool.
I'm giving back. So Columbia, give back as well. Forgive some of these loans, man.
Yeah,
I still got six figures.
Ooh. Yes, I think that you deserve it, and I also would encourage them to pay it forward to other folks. Anyway.
Well, see, I think you're in that showrunner seat, and you can say, you know, pay it forward to other people. I'm in another seat where I'm like, no, pay it to my Chase account. Pay it to the other people are me. Yeah.
Their names rhyme with Berman Fang. It's all good.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please,
tell us.
Well, Maine is completely central to how I got here. I grew up in Bangor, Maine, which is a really small town of like 30,000 people. And at the time that I was there, it was almost literally 100% white, except for me and my family and like one or two other families in town. And that was like kind of true for the whole state. And I was really self-conscious as a kid, like timid and shy, and also just, you know, felt so different from everybody else. I clearly was different. And I hid in my bedroom as a result my whole childhood, reading The Lord of the Rings over and over and over again, or Star Trek, or anything to do with Star Wars. I'm obsessed with Star Wars. You know, those stories like The Dragon Riders of Pern, The Chronicles of Narnia. In those stories, if you were different, it was cool. And you brought something to the table and you could be a hobbit and save the world. And, you know, I really gravitated toward that kind of storytelling. And also I was super bored because I lived in Bangor, Maine. There's nothing to do. Especially if your parents are academics and, you know, you have to like stay inside in the summer and do math problems. This is literal truth. And I would write these stories to entertain myself as an escapist kind of, you know. As an 8-year-old, I was writing Star Trek fan fiction. And because of, I guess, how my brain is hardwired, I would like set myself little goals every day. Like, I'm not going to go outside until I've written 5 pages in my little spiral notebook with my pencil. You know, I was very completist, even at that age. And so I wrote like a series of novellas about this super genius telekinetic, telepathic baby who got beamed up to the Enterprise with her, you know, sidekick. Also telepathic, also super genius telekinetic friend, but not quite as bright a shining star she was, because I was also growing up in my brother's shadow. I love my brother dearly, and he's a good friend and a math prodigy, like legit math prodigy, which in my household was the only currency. So I needed a way to feel special in my own mind. So I created this like series of novella adventures. Anyway, love science fiction. Yeah, thanks. Genre writing.
Who's optioned those? Where are you set up? Warner Brothers? Is Warner Brothers going to develop it?
That's really funny. I mean, I guess it's a little bit like the Powerpuff Girls. It would have that vibe, but no one is optioned. They're avail. Okay, so.
Rights are avail.
Oh,
rights
are avail. At any rate, because of those stories, I started to write genre fiction. Just, I loved it, you know. And then I had a long stretch where I was kind of like, well, I'm going to do something practical. Like go to business school or, you know, a lawyer or a doctor. And I found that none of those things really appealed to me. I went to Harvard undergrad, which is, you know, only by way of saying like, it actually had very little to do with how my life turned out. So if you're listening to this podcast and you don't have a fancy degree, please don't stress about it. Because I work with so many people who, you know, didn't go to college, didn't graduate, you know, high school even, I think. And their creative drive and their passion for what they do and the stories they have to tell are everything. Your degree, and I know lots of people with fancy degrees who are not working in the industry. So take heart.
I have to co-sign that big time, because we sit up here and talk about Columbia a lot and we joke about it a lot, but it is very, very much true. And never try to use that as a way to dissuade anybody, because you know what matters is what's on the page, and that comes from anywhere. But go on. Yeah. Sorry.
So you guys have at least 2 fancy degrees. Because Shu went to NYU and then Columbia.
That's not a fancy degree. NYU are you kidding?
NYU is a fancy degree. What are you talking about, bro?
A fancy degree.
Shu, are you this out of touch? That's a private university in New York City that costs $1 million a year. It is a fancy degree. Shu, Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. Okay, so please stop. Just stop.
Here we go.
I went to Wright State University, open admission in Dayton, Ohio.
Can we move on?
Okay, let's move on. Sorry.
I feel like, you know, what I meant to bring up was only that from everything on paper, my life was pointed in a certain direction. And then I just couldn't bring myself to do anything other than write eventually, because I realized it was the only thing that made me happy. And I came out to LA after film school because I was like, okay, well, now I'm going to be a famous screenwriter. This is going to be great. I had a couple of screenplays optioned for like very little money, but you know, there was a contract and my name was on it. And I was like, this is how it happens. I'm going to become a famous produced screenwriter. They're going to make these movies. I can finally tell my immigrant parents what this has all been about. They'll be proud of me finally, the neighbors. And that didn't come to pass through screenwriting, like film writing, because those options, you know, the films didn't get made. They were good experiences, but like many, many feature films, nothing happened. And I was out here just slogging away at day job after day job, just miserable, like Warner Brothers tour guide, short order cook in a bar, temp secretary. Mm. I mean, nothing to do with writings, could not get the phone answered. And then my boyfriend at the time said, you should apply for this thing called the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop. And I was like, oh, I write screenplays. I don't even watch TV. I work alone, you know? And he kind of cajoled me. And I was like, well, all right, let me sit down and watch this thing on TV that's on every night called Law and Order. That doesn't require a trip to the video store. That's how old I am. And I was like, okay, two guys moving a couch. They're talking about traffic. And then, oh my God, there's a body. Okay, minute one. Here are the cops. They talk about defensive wounds. She's been moved. She clearly knew her attack or something, something, something. Somebody makes a joke about the weather. And now we're out into titles. And so I was like, this is doable, you know, and I charted the whole progress of a Law and Order episode, which is actually one of the few shows you can really do that to. And I wrote a spec and I got into the program. And from there, long story short, I started to get the phone answered. I got an agent. I got hired as a diversity writer on the first season. Well, before Medium, which was kind of my bigger break, there was a show called Still Life, which was a really, you know, trial by fire as a person who's very introverted and didn't instinctively know how to handle politics in a small group of people who are, you know, writers. I was totally floundering and stressed out and just miserable. I couldn't believe I was having, you know, like this kind of paycheck, my dream job. And I'm like, never been so full of self-doubt and self-loathing. That was my first experience in TV.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
and then
can you drill down on that? Why self-doubt and loathing?
Oh, well, I think I was emotionally unprepared for the stress and challenges of being a TV writer. I think also that particular room, you know, even today, if you put me in that room today, I'd be like, okay, this is a tricky one to navigate. These are good people, very talented, but they've got some pre-existing relationships. Here's an arranged marriage between a showrunner and creator. We're a really small staff. I've been brought on as a diversity writer because they literally couldn't afford any other writer. We're short order. We don't have an air date. This is a fraught situation. I would know that now, you know, but I didn't know it then. I was like, hey, we're going to build a backyard rocket ship out of cardboard. I'm here, you know, and I was just not ready. And I didn't have the skills to read the room. That was one thing that I learned over time. I think if I had all those folks in front of me right now, among other things, I might say, I'm sorry I was blundering around all day. You must have been so annoyed with me. And actually, I don't have to imagine that. I know you were annoyed with me. Anyway. So that was my first experience. That show didn't go on the air. But then, you know, I at least had a credit. And then when Medium was hiring for its first season, I got hired on that, again, as a diversity staff writer. And I was, you know, delighted. Thank God somebody wanted to hire me. And ironically, the script that got me both jobs, or at least the meeting for both jobs, was one of the same features that I'd had optioned from film school, which was about Maine. So all of this is very full circle, because it had to do with, you know, a kid who, his best friend had drowned in an accident off the coast. He was only eight, didn't believe that his friend was dead, and kept insisting that his friend was just hiding. And it was all about his kind of coming to terms with, oh no, my friend actually drowned. And sometimes there's no closure because the sea hasn't brought the body back. But then the sea does bring the body back, which unfortunately actually happened to a girl I went to high school with. And so that inspired me to write this script set in this 2-week period of limbo when the town, everybody knows the kid is dead, but you don't have any closure because there's no body. So I couldn't write that now because I have kids, but at the time I was like, this is a really interesting thing to explore.
That's great. What I want to drill down on.
I have so many questions.
Yes. this is great.
You know, I started to get jobs after that. Bunch of different shows, lots of different learning experiences. Finally moved up the ladder to where I was, you know, on shows that, again, I was like, I've got all the circumstances that I wanted to get. Here I am working on this really cool show and I've got a really high title and yet I'm not satisfied yet. What is that about? Oh, it's because I want to be the boss. So let me stop taking meetings that are not showrunner meetings. And almost literally, you know, I don't want to say weeks, but it was very soon after I made that decision, I got the meeting for Nancy Drew, was fortunate enough to be hired on a terrific project. The pilot had already been greenlit. And I was being brought in to be, you know, the person on the battlefield while we were going up to Vancouver to shoot. And here we are.
Wow. Well, I have to say, I mean, you amongst, this is just a personal thing, you amongst some other people, including Julie in that room, were upper levels at Vampire Diaries. And occasionally people would take over duties to run the room. And I always had just a fantastic time with you running the room. So I'm not surprised at all that that happened. And I'm sure you are fantastic to work for. I always liked working with you.
Oh, thanks.
I just wanted to go back. I know Sherman has a couple questions too. So I just want to pepper you with some things along the way that you mentioned. And I definitely want to talk about Medium, which I think is one of them. I wrote a Medium spec, Sherm. You don't know this, way back when. One of the most underrated shows I think of all time. But anyway, so going back to talk to us about how you go to Harvard, you have a certain plan for your life. Mm-hmm. It's not working out. Mm-hmm. It must be a big decision to then shift like out of the business school, law school mode to mm-hmm. I'm going to go to film school.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that decision? How do your parents feel? Like, how does that happen?
This was actually my question. This was the first question I was going to ask. This is the gap that I want to bridge.
So I was completely set on a very practical, sensible route for my life up until the summer after junior year. In the summertime, the only thing that kept me from being homesick was when I would write. I would start to, you know, I'd write my journal or I'd just start writing, you know, little stories or whatever. And in those times, I would just go into that same place in my head that I used to go into as an 8-year-old in my bedroom in Maine. And everything else would disappear and I would be cool. I'd be okay, you know. I applied to the Tisch School of Dramatic Writing and I applied to Columbia. And Columbia had this catalog and I instantly had this gut feeling looking at their catalog like, ooh, look at all these different disciplines in film. Oh, you get to do all these different things in film. I'm going to apply to film instead of the theater writing program, instead of creative writing program. I love this idea of film. That's like something that other cool people get to do. I would love to try that. So I applied to the film program. I got into the Tisch School of the Arts, but the dramatic writing program is really small. And I was like, they're going to be mostly women. They're going to be, you know, I'm sure a lot of cool gay guys, but there's going to be like one straight guy and he's going to be a jerk. I'm not going to find a boyfriend there.
So you chose Columbia because of the boyfriend prospects?
Also, the joke was on me there too, but that's a whole other podcast. However, I also chose it because I really wanted to try all these different things. And it lit a spark in me that I didn't even know was there to be lit, you know?
Right. So I got sorry, Belinda, for those who don't know, Columbia's MFA program, what you're talking about is that it's split up into directing, writing, and producing. I imagine mm-hmm. it was when you went also. Yep. Yeah. So you could sort of, you know, spend a lot of time. If you did not go to like an undergraduate film mm-hmm. program or something, you could spend a lot of time directing or producing mm-hmm. yeah. Before you decided to, you know, concentrate on one thing.
And, right. I'll add that like you have to do all three.
You have to. Yes.
Early on, you have to do all three. And mm-hmm. I think for me, more commercials for Columbia, but for me, I applied to every, you know, major grad school as well. And, you know, one of the reasons why I chose Columbia is exactly that reason. Like a lot of the other mm-hmm. schools had their screenwriting program walled off.
You're
like you could do screenwriting and you could be in screenwriting classes all day, but you could never take a directing class. Right. You would never get a chance to produce a film. You just mm-hmm. had to write. And mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, young people who are exploring the film industry or television industry for the first time, it's really appealing to be able to try to be a writer director or a producer writer or so on and so forth. So
100%,
that was a big appeal. That was a big appeal for me.
Yeah, I found that incredibly valuable because you also take acting classes, which was fun and interesting. I mean, you learn a lot about writing when you're acting out somebody else's thing or realizing like, you know, I know the script says I'm supposed to cross the room, but I'm not a puppet. I want to leave, you know?
Yeah.
Right. So that was really valuable. And also as a TV writer, all of those things come into play. As you know, it's like there's so much producing, even when you're not technically a producer on the show. You're doing the things that a producer does if you're being trained up, like the Julie Plettkamp does, which I'm super grateful for, eternally grateful. Yeah. And the directing part of it, even if you don't aspire to be a director, if you can at least speak the language of like, the story I'm trying to tell is, this is a big, scary space, you know? Like, I don't need to tell you what lens to put on the camera, but I need to tell you in the tone meeting but I want the audience to get chills as soon as they walk in. So that was really, really valuable. And I really enjoyed my time there. Were you going to say something?
No, I was just agreeing with you that mm-hmm. I think that all those things are super valuable. And like, I think about my directing actors classes mm-hmm. and just being able to talk to the entire, in a tone meeting or concept mm-hmm. meeting, being able to talk to the whole crew about what is going on in this moment from a character standpoint and an mm-hmm. acting standpoint mm-hmm. and what it should look like and feel like from a directing standpoint. I'm just co-signing what you said. That is so valuable for writers to know a little bit about the other major aspects of filmmaking. It's really valuable.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even like talking to a stunt coordinator, one of my pet peeves on writers is when they choreograph the fight. I always think it's silly. Because A, we're not martial artists. B, we're not stunt people. C, we haven't been in the space that this is going to be filmed in. We don't know what the dimensions of the space are. Yeah. And also, you know, it's like, it's presumptuous. It's like, and it never looks as cool as you think it's going to look, even if they did every one of the moves you've choreographed, wing quotes. But I like to talk to stunt coordinators and script fights the way that I would talk to an actor. Like, Enzo wants to kill Stefan. Stefan is just trying to subdue Enzo. Enzo grew up fighting in bars. Stefan learned his things, like, you know, as an army, like he's a really, I actually had that conversation with the stunt coordinator for that Enzo Stefan fight. Like, I remember what episode it was. But that's all the stunt coordinator needs to know. This guy fights dirty and he's trying to kill the other guy. That tells you a lot.
This is such inside baseball, but I love this is what this podcast is about. That is a lesson that I have learned as a writer. Because I would script like left hand punch to the jaw, falls down to a knee, kicks him in the chest, whatever. And then I literally just, you know, a week ago scripted a fight, on Animal Kingdom, and the words in the script literally are, they fight, it's bloody, they get the best of each other. We'll wait for the production meeting to we'll deal with this we'll wait for prep to do.
I wrote something recently and it said you know, one character follows the other character, they start to run, and then all caps underline a chase. And that was it. Because it's like, I don't know what the street is. I don't know what street they're going to be on. I don't know what obstacles are going to be in their way with it. You know, like, we got to figure out the chase once we shoot it. But I can't give you details.
That's so funny. I want to skip us forward a little bit.
Sure.
Melinda. So you enjoy Columbia. It sounds like it's a great experience. You go into this, you know, I'm condensing the story, but you go into, go to LA, you go to the Warner Brothers writing workshop. You get that first job, which is sounds a little troublesome. Nothing ever goes on air. And then you're into, I think I'll pronounce his name. Is it Glenn Gordon Caron? So you go into the medium room.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like this is the first real experience where shows are going to get things that you've written get to air.
Yes. Yeah. That was exciting.
So talk about that experience. And then we'll move forward, but talk about mm-hmm. that experience, since it was kind of the first one where you went through the whole process mm-hmm. and how that room was different from the previous experience you had had.
It was a really unusual room among a lot of rooms I've been in, because Glenn's process is to rewrite everything, and it has to go through his computer. And what comes out is really great. I mean, it was very interesting to me to pitch ideas that he would respond to, and I would write a whole storyline. And or I would pitch out the storyline, and he'd be like, that's so saccharine, I feel my diabetes acting up, my teeth are shivering. I mean, I was like, okay. But the way that he redid the storyline, based on the kind of genesis of Allison shakes the hand of one of Joe's coworkers and has a premonition that this guy's going to die of a heart attack in 3 days. And she tells Joe, you need to warn this guy. And Joe's like, I'm not going to do that. So it becomes like a kind of a story about how couples react to, you know, this situation. And Joe was still more of a skeptic at that time. He was like, you don't know that this is going to happen. Ultimately, the guy did die of a heart attack. But the way that I wanted the story to end, the way I pitched it was like, you find out like the following Monday that this guy's estranged daughter has come to pick up his stuff and is packing file box. And Joe meets her and says, I'm really sorry about your father. And she said, yeah, you know, he and I hadn't spoken for 20 years. And then out of the blue, he called me last Thursday, right before he passed away. And I'm so glad that we talked. It seemed like he had a conversation with somebody that made him think that, you know, he needed to take care of things, or, you know, so it had this good outcome. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that Glenn thought was too saccharine.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So, okay. You know, that was just me reliving a little like punch to the ribs, but that's kind of the life of a TV writer. Sometimes, I mean, that is the job. You pitch something yes. that you feel very strongly about, and you have to be able to step away from the heavy bag. I mean, this is another thing that I learned from my martial arts teacher, because after one toxic experience on a different show, my agent was like, honey, you need to get into some martial arts training because you have a lot of anger.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, nobody that you guys know was that job. But anyway, so, you know, as a writer, you have to be able to pitch with your whole heart and then just step back and not let the bag hit you on the way back from your punch, because that's what it does. It's going to swing back. And, you know, Glenn rewrote that story to be something more cerebral, but also philosophical and poignant. And, you know, the important part of the story remained, which was that Allison had a premonition and the guy did die, and it had an impact on Joe, and they had like a lot of relationship talk about it.
So you talked about, just real quick, like, throughout your experience, I mean, one of the first things I think you have to adjust to as a TV writer is that notion of sort of like not only getting shot down, but also getting rewritten. Because, I mean, you begin your career alone, writing things that, right. you know, and making those decisions on your own of what's good, what's going to work, et cetera. You know, I just wondered, like, just not just with Medium, but just in your career going forward from that point, like, How do you adjust to sort of being rewritten? Is there a way that you prefer to be rewritten or not that you take with yourself as a showrunner now? Yeah. Like, how do you wrestle with that?
I want to add, now that you're a showrunner, how do you handle having to rewrite or not rewrite your staff?
Right.
All the above.
Yeah, I think that you develop a muscle memory about being rewritten in a way where you kind of, you don't get as attached to the stuff you write, especially if you're working for someone who likes to rewrite. You need to go in knowing that is part of what you're getting paid for, is that you will submit your stuff, you will polish it. It's not falling on my ear quite right, you know, and then it comes back. You don't even recognize it, but your name is still on the script. And you may not like the jokes and you may not like the storyline. Sometimes that is the job. Not always, but sometimes. Yeah. And then so other times it comes back and you're like, wow, that's way better than what I sent in and my name's on the script. Great. You know? Yeah. But, the other thing that, I mean, as a showrunner now, what we do on Nancy Drew, we have the writers do their own draft, you know, and then they come back and we roundtable it with the whole room, which is always so beneficial. And the writers don't have to take every note, but we'll kind of talk about it as a group. And sometimes it can be a pretty exhaustive pulling apart of what the story is. We also try to roundtable at the outline stage. We do a kind of longish beat sheet or shortish outline. And a lot of things can, you know, the superstructure gets exposed at that point. And so you can save yourself a lot of heartache by saying, oh, you know what, this B story shouldn't be 5 beats. It should be 3 beats or whatever. But the writers come back with a draft. We roundtable the draft. They have a chance to turn those notes around. And then Noga and I will do our passes on it. Noga and I have kind of a hive mind thing going. We just happen to have a really good blend of sensibilities. Not all arranged marriages are like this. It wasn't arranged. I mean, Noga really liked me in the interview. But,
can you talk about who Noga is and who they are in relationship to the show?
Noga Landau created Nancy Drew along with Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage of Fake Empire. And she is the EP of the show and will be co-showrunning with me in season 3. And during the first couple of years of the show, we got into a really good groove where, you know, we'll sometimes do a pass together. Zoom was great for that because you share your screen and you're just kind of like working together, almost like you're sharing a typewriter. One person is driving and the other person is just commenting and then you trade off. But where we can say, this bit doesn't work for me. Like, what should this scare be? And Noga takes care of all the supernatural scares because that's her thing. Or I might be like, I feel like we're saying the word, you know, diverse twice in 2 sentences. Right. let's say, you know, inclusive in the second sentence or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, or I'll talk about structural stuff. I mean, we both have different things that we tend to hone in on and we have similar things that we hone in on together. But that way, after the writers had really a couple of go-rounds with the material, then, and sometimes, you know, if we really have a lot of time, we'll even give a round of quick notes before the round table with the full room. So they've had multiple opportunities to get their arms around it. And then they're used to the process where we rewrite some of it. But I don't think that we're as heavy rewriters as many people are. And then we also have this wonderful number two named Alex Taub, who does the Zamboni pass. It's what we call it. Like, he comes behind us like a Zamboni and just tidies up the edges and adds really funny one-liners to the dialogue and points out structural inconsistencies, or just kind of like, wouldn't this be a better button if we felt like she was driving towards the next thing? Or he's such a pro. It's like fantastic. So I think the combination of those passes elevates the script. And then, you know, as we get into the production meetings, then we hand it back to the writer, because by then Noga and I are on to the next script and we don't have time to do all the production revisions. Although we did a lot of the production revisions for this latter part of season two. However, normally the writer of the episode is doing all their own production revisions, which is great. You know, it's a time-consuming process. It's a very important process. And it gives them, you know, more ownership, you know, coming back into the production part of the cycle. And then they're involved in editing and, you know, all the ADR that happens in editing, and you end up writing a bit of the show in the editing room. So they're heavily involved.
Got you. I have a question for you. Now that you're a showrunner, and I think we, you know, just to orient this, we have a lot of absolute beginners, pre-professional, aspiring writers who listen to this show and are trying to get a peek behind the curtain. So as a showrunner, can you talk a little bit about what you look for in hiring a new writer? What boxes do you need them to check? What skills do you need them to have? Obviously, they're not going to have all the skills of a TV writer who's been through three or four seasons. But what are the initial sort of baseline prerequisite things you're looking for when you hire a new writer?
One is the voice of the writer, because there are a lot of fantastic writers who would be really wrong for Nancy Drew. And, you know, I consider myself a strong writer, and I'd be really wrong for, like, Animal Kingdom, I'm pretty sure. Or Shameless. I could never write Shameless. My monocle would pop out. Anyway. But I, you know, I've read a couple of scripts recently where I'm like, this person has never been on staff, but they'd be great for this show. I just really like kind of the buoyancy of their writing. You know, this happens to fit what I'm looking for. This isn't that every script has to be buoyant. But for me, I really responded to the buoyancy of this person's writing, the specificity of the story that she was telling, the characters, kind of what was driving them. I understood at every moment where they were emotionally in the scene with each other. And I really was interested in where the series was going to go, because it was a spec pilot. So there's that. I personally really respond to a sense of humor. I always, you know, I enjoy reading funny scripts. And sometimes, you know, the script is like too funny for what I want to do, but it doesn't mean I won't enjoy it. But I do look for what a person's background is in terms of, you know, because Tom Swift in Success, Knockwood, is going to be a show that is very resonant, hopefully, with a Black audience and with a queer audience. We definitely want folks from those worlds on the staff. They don't have to be both things. They don't have to be either or, but we need a lot of people who at least are some of those things, if not both. And, you know, I love hiring women. I also love hiring Asian people. I am not ashamed to say that, especially after listening to your last week's podcast.
I mean, that the McKinsey report thing, is that what you were,
Totally.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be intentional.
Yeah, you do. And then sometimes I also kind of feel like, oh, I get down on white men for hiring other white men, or I don't like trash talk them, but I do notice it when white men hire people who are very similar to them, not just in like background experience, socioeconomic, you know, kind of upbringing, but also like literally look like them. I think that's a little weird, but whatever. So
that is, I've seen that before.
That's a thing. Yeah.
It's like, a thing.
You just like this person because they kind of look and dress
literally
like
look
you. That's the reason why they're your number two and they're your go-to person. They look like a 10-year younger version of you. That's why you hired them.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's not get too far in that rabbit hole. But it's good. But I also am introduced to a lot of young Asian writers because I, you know, participate in the CAPE Fellowship mentoring stuff, or, you know, other, like I helped organize the Asian American Women's Writers Brunch. So I'm meeting a lot of folks who are in that category. And naturally, I want to mentor them, you know, coming up the ranks. And so it's a little bit of a self-selecting thing, I guess. But you also, you know, one is being intentional about it. And sometimes I think, like, if I don't mentor this person, if I don't give this person a shot, who's going to do it?
So I wanted to ask, you know, you said something very interesting. I'm bringing it full circle. You said something very interesting about how the Black Lives Matter movement really affected the stories that you guys were coming up with in the room. And I'm wondering, do you predict that you will have sort of more Asian or Asian American stories that comment on this moment in our society in Nancy Drew or in upcoming work?
Good question.
Yeah, that is a good question. Probably, yeah. I mean, now that you've said it, I feel like we should. I actually was going to bring up a storyline that we have right now. So this is an interesting, I don't know, philosophical slight quandary. So here's what happened. We have an episode coming up. It's going to be on the air on May 7th, where, spoiler, one of our characters gets possessed by the ghost of an elderly Chinese aunt, who the character of the Chinese aunt is a woman in her 80s who grew up in China, came to the States, speaks with an accent, and was very hard on George, our character, you know, our friend of Nancy Drew. And the person who the ghost possesses is Ace, again, spoiler, who is a tall white dude from Missouri, good-looking guy, great actor, Alex Saxon. And I had many, many conversations with Alex about, like, initially, we were kind of like, maybe this character should not have an accent. Maybe we should just avoid it altogether. And then a lot of conversations with Alex and the director of the episode, Ramtin Nikkal, with our, you know, co-EP, Larry Tang, you know, who, you know, was very vocal about, like, we don't want to do something that is a character or offensive or, like, you know, is this the moment for this? Sure. And we went around and around about it. And what we came up with, and, you know, also consulted, like, really veteran actor friends of mine and kind of, like, got a lot of perspectives on this. And what Alex came up with through these conversations and with a lot of support from me, particularly, and the writer of the episode, Lisa Bao, her, you know, parents also talk like this. My parents speak with an accent. I mean, my dad has passed on, but he spoke with a very heavy accent. And when I was a kid, I was embarrassed by that. I didn't want to be associated with it. I was just like, oh, if they could only talk like the Americans in town. If only we had a name that wasn't weird, like Shoe, like what kind of name is that? Couldn't we be named Smith? You know, or Wong, people can understand Wong. I had a whole like, you know, inner turmoil about it as a kid. And I came such full circle around it that when I was, I've been talking to the cast about this, I talked to other writers about this. I'm proud of my parents' accent. My parents' accent says that they came from China as grownups. They were refugees on boats when the communists took over. They had to learn English from missionaries and teachers. They made a life for themselves in another country. They had kids who then went into TV writing and could put on the air their version of what an elder's love looks like when a ghost inhabits somebody else. Doesn't matter who that person looks like, but the love comes across the cultures, across the generations, across the lifespan. And I became a little bit like, you know, I'm going out on a limb here, but I think we should do the accent. And Alex portrayed this elder Aunt May. It's such a beautiful, just kind of like, he speaks not as Alex Saxon, who is from Missouri. He speaks as an elderly woman who really loves her niece and is also really hard on her niece. It is also very blunt because that's the culture, and is ruthlessly honest because she thinks it's being helpful. And at the end of the day, is so concerned about what's going on with her niece that you just feel this incredible connection between the two actors. And you don't feel like it's Alex Saxon, blonde guy from Missouri. You feel like it's Aunt May warning George about something that she sees in her future or a possibility for her, you know, really imploring her to take care of herself and to fix this problem. And it was just a lovely, lovely scene.
Oh, I love that. That sounds like such that story. A beautiful way to put it. And I think, you know, it sort of goes to show, and I'm a big proponent of this, that just really depicting Black culture, Asian culture, minority cultures with, you know, sensitivity and real humanity and love goes a long way to, I think, improving how people relate to other people. And I think it's, I don't think it's an overstatement to say that those kind of depictions can really change the way people interact in the real world.
God, I hope so. Because, you know, the flip side of it is like people are worried. Like, what if we're, you know, we don't want the audience to feel like we're making fun of the accent, which we are not. But I also kind of felt like if we did no accent, if Alex Saxon says these things in his Midwestern, you know, very dry delivery, I love how he talks, but he doesn't talk like an old Chinese lady. You know, are we missing an opportunity to put that kind of intonation? And it's really not an accent that he does. It's more like an inflection. It's a speech, almost mannerism, as opposed to an accent. But are we missing an opportunity to show the audience, to detach the audience's visual of an older Chinese person from the way that they talk, and to kind of reclaim the accent? This is where I came down to reclaim the accent by juxtaposing it with a good-looking white guy from Missouri. I keep saying Missouri, but that's where he's from. And, you know, to let them readjust their brain so that that accent, hearing that accent, doesn't always equal other, doesn't always equal old person who I can dismiss and ignore and shut the door on when she's getting a beat down in broad daylight. Jesus Christ, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's a hell of a way to put it. I love that.
So, knock wood.
Yes, yes, I love that. You know, you talked about being an introverted kid. You talked about being, you know, an Asian kid in a all-white town, about sort of carrying some of those and writing sort of as a way to sort of think of yourself as more, or to sort of get out of you know, go to other worlds in your head and that kind of thing, which I think a lot of people can relate to. And you talked about carrying that sort of personality into your first jobs as an introverted sort of person. So I just wonder, you know, it's a sort of a broad question, but I just wonder now as the boss, when you look back on sort of that introverted writer, a minority writer, a female writer in these rooms, what are the things that you've learned that you can pass along, and anything that you sort of try to be mindful of as the boss now?
Right. I love that question. One thing, going back to my martial arts instructor, he taught me a couple of really valuable lessons. Among them are, when you engage, engage. Because he was coaching me on self-defense, and I would be kind of hesitant, kind of like, you know, and he was kind of like, if you're going to hit the bag, hit the bag. Or if you're going to block the punch, block the punch. Don't kind of half do it. But his way of saying it was, when you engage, engage. And I think that's really true with pitching, with writing, you know, with just kind of being in meetings, with being out in the world with your ideas. I think that, you know, another thing that he said that was really valuable when this kind of self-defense exercise was going on, he would do this thing where he would like kind of advance on my space. And sometimes I would start to throw a punch or block something. He'd be like, what? I didn't hit you. I'm not even that close to you. But then he kept advancing on my space. And I kept stepping back. And he says, there comes a point when you don't step back. And the next time he like threw a punch at me, I blocked it. And then we went at it. So that is really helpful in life, I think, when you feel like, this is the thing that's important to me. I'm going to incorporate social justice and volunteerism into the writer's room. I'm going to be out there and saying what I think. You know, there comes a point when you don't step back. So that's one thing in life, I think, and that kind of permeates the writer's room and kind of how you approach your craft, your job, your life. But I also feel like, as an introvert, one thing is just practice. I encourage people actually to do improv comedy, you know, just like low stakes with friends kind of stuff, because that really taught me to commit to a bit, you know, to just say it and not second guess it and not be in my head about it. And also the more you do it with, you know, judicious use of this in the writer's room, the more you do, the more you feel like, okay, well, that one didn't land. Let me try again in a little bit when I have an idea, you know, and you kind of get better at assessing when people are not saying anything else, or, you know, you got to row in the same direction as other people and start with kind of like, here's what I like about that pitch. It sparks in me this idea. Here's a specific approach I have to, you know, figuring out a thing that I sparked to, and here's the outcome that I'm trying to get to. And then you stop talking. It's very important to stop talking after you've pitched. A lot of young writers don't get that. They keep trying to sell the idea when people are trying to absorb it. And the other thing, my big takeaway, I guess, as an introvert, is that you just have to get out of your own head. It's easier said than done. So I really encourage people to take up mindfulness meditation. This is real advice. To have other hobbies and pursuits and things in their life that they feel good about, so that when you're in the room pitching, when you're watching what's going on the board, when you're feeling like, oh, that person makes the showrunner laugh. Why doesn't the showrunner laugh at my jokes? You know, that is a cul-de-sac of pain. That's not going to help you. That's a phrase we came up with on Medium. When we feel like, no, that pitch is never going to work with Glenn. This is a cul-de-sac of pain. Let's get out of it. you know, that. You have to build up other things in your life so that being a writer isn't the only thing that brings you joy or meaning or self-worth or a sense of identity. Because then you can go in and really, you know, be in the job, but not feel like everything hangs on the next pitch, whether it lands or not. Also, another thing I do when I'm unemployed, I take pottery classes sometimes. And I was talking to my pottery teacher about this friend's pottery, Angela, made these wonderful vases and jugs. And Angela was always very dissatisfied with her pottery. And I said to the teacher, I don't understand why Angela hates her pottery so much. And the teacher said, that's because she is focused on the result. Because Angela had this idea of what the pottery was supposed to look like. And it was getting in the way of her process of just making pottery. So I think that's really important as a writer and as a person pitching in the writer's room. You can't be focused on the result. You have to be in the process.
Ugh, love that.
Thanks.
Jewels. Love dropping that. All kinds of jewels. Love it. Love that. And let me tell you something. Cul-de-sac of pain is going to enter my daily vocabulary yes. now. I love that.
Once you say it, how does it get out of your head? You can't.
But you get a better sense of when you're in one. It's good. It's a good, yes. like, you know, no, wait, I'm here. True. I'm here. I'm in the cul-de-sac.
Cul-de-sac of pain. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Melinda. We're going to have you stick around for Don't Do That Shit.
Oh, yes.
But thank you. That was really, really, really fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
My pleasure. This has been great. Thank you.
Shoot, you know, you already previewed it. It's time to get into everybody's favorite segment, what they skip the whole episode to get to every single week, I'm sure. Don't Do That Shit, a segment where we give you a little bit of bite-sized advice in the format of telling you what not to do. A lot of people give you positive, encouraging advice. We're going to tell you what to avoid and what to stop, and it's going to make your writing better. It's going to make your career better. It's probably going to make your entire life better, so... obviously we have a guest in the house, so I would like to give the floor to our esteemed guest and ask you, Melinda, do you have a Don't Do That Shit for us this week?
One piece of advice I like to give writers, young writers particularly, is don't apologize for pitching. And especially women, I will say, that are more frequently in the writer's room, I've heard them saying, sorry, that drives me insane. I actually had a writer who I think is a fantastic writer, and if she's listening to this podcast, she knows who she is. I gave her a jar and I was like, every time I hear you say, sorry, you owe me $1. The jar filled up pretty quickly. And then she started to train herself out of the habit, because she would have these great pitches, but they would be preceded by sorry. And I'd be like, what are you apologizing for? That's a great pitch. Also, you know, I told this to the CAPE Fellowship mentees. As a new writer coming into the room, particularly if you're a diversity writer and there may be older veteran writers in the room who are like, oh, great, here's the free brown person. You need to prove yourself three times over to that person. Do not dismiss your own pitch before you speak. If you're going to speak, speak with a purpose. Engage when you engage, and don't dismiss yourself. How are they going to take you seriously if you dismiss yourself?
Ugh, great advice. That. Nothing that's more great. To add. Great advice.
That's great advice. That's great.
Shu, what do you have? A Don't Do That Shit for this week?
Yes, it's mine is not nearly as good. I must say on that.
I know we should have finished with that one.
I know.
That was like, that's like a drop the mic moment.
My Don't Do That Shit this week is may be a repeat, because we're starting to get into these where I feel like they may be repeats, but I have been guilty of this, but it is still annoying to read, even though I do it sometimes. Please don't overwrite feelings in action description. We cannot see the feelings. We may need to know them and emotionally track them in characters, but try to do that with, I don't know, the character's actions, maybe, as opposed to telling us exactly how they feel from beat to beat to beat in action description. Although I will say I think in modern writers or writers, you know, these days or whatever, all do it to a certain extent, and I think there's a reason for that, but it has become a bit of an epidemic to me, and seeing all this feeling that I should be gathering from the scene and the things that are playing out in the scene that I'm just getting from lazy writing in the action description. So please don't do that shit.
Sure, I love that. And the cheat that I use is I try to always, if I say a feeling, I try to couple it with an action.
Yes.
I try to give you the action, and then if I need, I try not to put feelings in there, but I try to say, like, you know, he hesitates at the door. He's scared, right? Like, I'm giving you an action and a feeling together, as opposed to just saying he's scared or he's sad, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, you really, if you can sort of cheat it if you couple it with an action.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. My Don't Do That Shit is, you know, what is this Don't Do That Shit? I think it's a variation of something you said before, Shakri, which is like, don't try to teach me a lesson with your script. And I want to say that, like, don't do this shit. don't try to fix sort of the social issues around your script until you fix the characters first. Because writing a good character can solve a lot of the sort of extra textual social issues that you're concerned about. If you're concerned about, for example, a character of a certain minority class being stereotypical, work on that character. Make that character a full, living, breathing person. Give that character an objective that's their own, that's totally separated from the white characters or the other characters in the world. Make them a three-dimensional person, and then watch how the feeling of stereotypes sort of fades away as you build up that character. If you're worried about a female character feeling subservient or diminished with the other male characters, build up the character. Build up the character and the story around her. Make that character feel fuller and more three-dimensional, and watch how that starts to fade away. Now, you might still have more work to do, and that's not going to solve every single problem that might get you called out on Twitter. Obviously, some issues you have to do more with. But I think starting with the character is where you solve those problems first and foremost, before you can just sort of abstractly fix and insulate yourself from the social commentary you might get once it comes out.
That's great. I think it's a great callback to the story Milena was telling too. But so yeah, that's great. I like that.
You have been listening to The Diversity Hires. I told you before, and I'll tell you again, you can find us across all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Div Hires Pod. You can also hit that Patreon page and donate monthly to keep this little podcast afloat. That's patreon.com/Div Hires Pod. I'm your host, Sherman Payne.
And I am your host, Shukri Hassan Tillman. This show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton, also known as AKB. Shout out to you. Also, our social media director, Tia Wren, who is doing a fantastic job. Tia, keep it up. As Sherman mentioned, please follow us on all the socials. But also, you can reach out to us at thediversityhires.com. You can join the mailing list where we post a bunch of resources that we mention in each of the episodes. And also, you can write to us at thediversityhires.com. You can suggest episodes. You can tell us what we did wrong. You can say you hate us. You can whatever. We'll take some hate mail. Why not? But you can also tell us that you love us and you want us to do more. And last but not least, please, please go to wherever you pick up this podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever, and rate the podcast. We're trying to get to 100 ratings pretty soon. We're very close to, I think we got 50 plus five-star ratings or something like that, but we want to get to 100. So we appreciate your support. Please, please, please share the podcast with everybody you know, screenwriters or not. I know we have a lot of non-screenwriting listeners, which is like fascinating to me. I get people who are involved in politics that call me. I love the podcast. They don't write at all. Yeah. I have no idea why they listen, but they love it. So please, please share the podcast with everybody you know. And we'll see you next week on The Diversity Hires.
Peace, y'all.